You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Updating Outpatient Recommendations in COVID-19 Management, Identifying Opportunities for Risk Reduction in Non-Hospitalized Patients. I'm Deb Gordon, and I'm joined by Dr. Richard Martinello, an infectious disease specialist and professor in the Departments of Internal Medicine and Pediatrics at the Yale School of Medicine in New Haven. Today, we'll focus on evaluating current clinical criteria when selecting patients for COVID-19 therapeutics using a shared decision-making approach. Welcome, Dr. Martinello.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Deb.
It's been 3 years since we all woke up to something called COVID-19. How has the world changed since then, particularly from your perspective as an infectious disease specialist and in medicine?
Well, I think this time has gone extraordinarily fast, but also it's been a very, I think, exhausting time at the same time. And I think for our infectious diseases community, I think we're very appreciative for really the world to have grown in its understanding of the role of infectious diseases and infectious disease specialists, and how these infections and pandemics can really impact our lives, our economies, and really our day-to-day efforts. And I think that said, I think we all look forward to getting back to some semblance of normal, but at the same time recognize that our normal as we come out of the pandemic is going to be different than what we had seen prior to.
Yeah, it's definitely gonna always be with us. When I think back to those early days, you know, it was horrible. People were dying. A lot of people were dying. I know people are still dying today, but you all had nothing. You had very little. You had no idea how to treat people. Reflect a little bit on that and then where we are now today.
Yeah, I think that brings back quite a few memories and to think about where we were. And it wasn't only so much that we had no specific medications with which to treat COVID, but also there was a lack of understanding for exactly how the pathogen was transmitted person to person. We had a lack of resources to allow us a rapid diagnosis of COVID. And I think what was most impressive was how not only across the United States, but elsewhere across the globe, really came together to very rapidly perform research and share information on how the impact that we were seeing from COVID, how estimates were being made for how the disease was transmitted, and then extraordinary efforts to try to better understand how to protect our staff and to treat our patients. And it was really remarkable to watch in such a short period of time how, you know, seemingly day to day, new information was becoming available on each of those subjects. I think now we're very lucky to have not only effective vaccines, but we have a number of medications which we use, which we know to be effective, and rapid diagnostics are readily available to us. So a lot of tools that have become available and in common use in a very short period of time.
And I just want to remind our listeners that the other part of this podcast, there are two in the series, talks more about that initial diagnosis and testing. So moving back to where we are today with therapeutics, I want to start with something ironically that's no longer available, which are the monoclonal antibodies. We used to have several available and they've been sort of just dropping like proverbial flies. So explain what's going on there.
Well, I think something that is new to us for this pandemic has been the accessibility of molecular diagnostics. And the use of those molecular diagnostics in the research laboratory setting to better understand how the virus itself has evolved. And in this evolution, identifying novel variants. This was really a concept that had not been known in previous pandemics. And certainly we've seen clinical impact from it because it allowed us to understand how well our monoclonals and other therapeutics were working, And then also how to adapt those monoclonal antibodies to make sure that they were effective. So as new variants arose and spread, when we found that those new variants were not effectively managed by the current monoclonal antibody, you know, we saw very quickly new monoclonals being formed and adapted. Unfortunately, though, we're in a bit of a gap right now, I think, where we no longer have any monoclonal antibodies that are known to be effective to treat or to prevent COVID. But I know there's a lot of work ongoing to try to continue focused development of those monoclonals.
So today we have three outpatient treatments for people with who develop COVID-19. Tell us about those.
The most common one which we use is a combination medication that goes by the trade name Paxlovid. And that's a combination of the two medications, nirmatrelvir and ritonavir. A second medication is molnupiravir. And the third one, which we see relatively infrequently used, is an intravenous infusion that goes by the name of remdesivir. And of course, remdesivir has been around the longest of those three medications. And we've primarily used it in the inpatient setting, both now and in the past.
So let's start with Paxlovid. Tell us about it. Give us a little idea of the mechanism of action. And how should it be prescribed? How and when should it be prescribed?
Well, Paxlovid is an oral medication. It comes in a blister pack, with each blister pack containing the day's worth of medication. And it's to be prescribed for a 5-day period. It is recommended for those who have risk factors that we know put them at greater risk for the progression to more severe manifestations of COVID. And it's been shown that the use of Paxlovid is able to decrease not only the frequency of hospitalization for this patient population, but also to decrease mortality. It works by inhibiting how well the virus is able to propagate, and therefore it limits the spread of that virus in an individual's body.
The studies have been very impressive, and yet we've seen a lot of evidence that it's underprescribed. Why is that?
Well, I think there's probably a few reasons why we see it underprescribed. One is I think there's some lack of understanding of how well it actually works, and a lack of understanding of how accessible it is to our patients. I think third, we do have some concern that about what's been described as being called Paxlovid rebound. And this rebound is a phenomena where when somebody is taking that 5-day course of Paxlovid, they are feeling better, starting to improve. But then after the medication discontinues, we see them have an experience, a return of their symptoms. They may again have fever. And there has been concern that perhaps that is something unique to Paxlovid, but I think with further study that has not been found to be the case, that it is thought to be due to just the natural history of that individual's infection rather than anything specific to their receiving Paxlovid.
So you talked about it being prescribed for, it should be prescribed for high-risk patients. Who are high-risk patients?
There's a fairly lengthy list of characteristics that may put somebody at higher risk for more severe disease due to COVID. The most common issues that we see are obesity, older age with an age of 65 or greater, or sometimes even 50 or greater. We also have on that list persons who have diabetes, either type 1 or type 2 diabetes, persons with hypertension, with kidney insufficiency, and those who have underlying cardiac or pulmonary issues.
And it should be prescribed pretty soon after a person thinks they have COVID.
Absolutely. You know, similar to other acute viral illnesses, these medications work best when they are prescribed early in the person's course. So once they have had that diagnosis of COVID, it's best to go ahead and start the medication at that point. Sometimes we hear clinicians saying, well, I'm just going to wait a few days and see how they do. But of course, during those few days, if they experience some degree of progression, the effectiveness of the medication may not be as good as if it started early on. So it is a strong recommendation to start that medication, that antiviral medication, as soon as possible.
So one thing we hear a lot about, and which may also be behind the reluctance of some clinicians to prescribe, there's a lot of drug-drug interactions with Paxlovid.
Absolutely correct. And Paxlovid is a dual medication. It contains nirmatrelvir, which is a protease inhibitor, and then it also contains ritonavir. And the purpose of the ritonavir is to boost the nirmatrelvir levels. But ritonavir is known to have a multitude of drug-drug interactions. Now, most of the time, our patients are able to tolerate it and are able and don't have any contraindications to taking this medication. However, it's important that if they are taking medications, for the clinician prescribing Paxlovid to make sure that they look up to see if there are any potential drug-drug interactions. Sometimes we see that the other medication that's interacting with the ritonavir can simply be stopped for the five-day course. But other times, if their medication cannot be stopped and it's a significant interaction, then we may not be able to use Paxlovid and we need to consider one of the two other medications we mentioned.
And before we go on to the other two medications, final question on Paxlovid is side effects. And how should clinicians monitor them and advise their patients?
Well, far and away, the most common side effect is what we call dysgeusia. And this is where the individual taking Paxlovid develops a metallic taste that could be relatively intense. But once they stop taking the medication, so after their five-day course, that sense of the metallic taste in their mouth will diminish and resolve fully over time.
Great. Now we have the other oral antiviral, molnupiravir, which we do not hear a lot about. Why is that?
Now, molnupiravir works by a different mechanism. And the mechanism is that it creates a situation where the virus, as it is replicating, develops a lot of errors in that replication. And those accumulating errors end up preventing the virus from effectively replicating over time. And some of the clinical studies that were done suggested that this medication, molnupiravir, may not be as effective as Paxlovid. And while the two have still not been compared head-to-head, because the studies were done in relatively similar ways, I think most clinicians, as they review the data in the literature, have the sense that molnupiravir does not seem to work as effectively as Paxlovid. And for that reason, it does typically get a second recommendation in our guidelines rather than being a top-tier recommendation. I think the other issue is because of its mechanism of effect, while we do not have any data suggesting that it is teratogenic, there is concern of what its impact may be on a developing fetus. And so molnupiravir is relatively contraindicated for use in women who may be pregnant.
And how about remdesivir?
Well, we continue to really rely on remdesivir as our primary antiviral for our patients who have moderate to severe COVID and who are hospitalized due to their COVID. So we continue to use it extensively for our inpatient population. Recently, though, there was some data showing its effectiveness when it's used for individuals who have mild to moderate COVID and remain in the ambulatory setting. The reason we don't use it as frequently as we do Paxlovid or even molnupiravir is because it's an IV-only formulation at this point. It's provided intravenously once a day for a three-day period, and it's logistically difficult for our clinical offices and other settings to arrange three consecutive days of IV therapy for our ambulatory patients. And so while it is known to be very effective, a very safe medication to use, we see it used less frequently because of those logistical considerations.
Great. So now let's move on to another focus of this podcast, which is shared decision making. What does that mean in a clinical experience, shared decision making with patients?
So shared decision making really means discussing the options that you feel are clinically viable with the patient, discussing the pros and cons for each of those options, and helping the patient work through those pros and cons and developing an understanding of what is the best option for them to pursue. And I think it's really important to recognize that we are not just asking the patient themselves to make the decision. We are guiding them through what we understand of the data, what we think are reasonable decisions, and help them decide which is the best decision for them.
Great. One last question before we wrap up, and that is, what's coming down the road in terms of outpatient therapies? What are you seeing in the clinical trials?
We continue to see a great deal of research investigating small molecule medications. And we're also seeing some work to adapt our IV medications for oral use, and specifically remdesivir. We are looking forward to when an oral formulation of remdesivir is available. We continue to see some work being done on monoclonal antibodies, and there continues to be some research on convalescent plasma.
Great. So would you say you're optimistic as we look into the future?
Yes, yes. I am very optimistic, and I expect that we'll see some continued work trying to improve not only our treatment regimens, but also work to continue and better understand our diagnostic strategies to identify those who have COVID and can benefit from treatment.
Wonderful. That's all the time we have today, but I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to speak about this very important topic, particularly outpatient therapeutic treatment in high-risk patients. And I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. We hope you'll listen to the other episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Pfizer, who provided an educational grant for this activity.